National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The Supreme Court may take up a significant religious freedom question next term on whether a city or state can require religious adoption services to place children with same-sex couples despite their faith-based objections. What does this mean for people of faith? This week on Register Radio, we talk to Joan Frawley Desmond, the Register's senior editor, about the role that Catholics play in foster care and how much need there is for solid foster families. And we also discuss with Joan the ongoing crisis at the John Paul II Institute in Rome. Is the Catholic identity of this iconic school in danger? I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register.
And I'm Matthew Bunsen, senior editor for the Register. Well, the question of deeply held religious beliefs and the right to live them out is emerging as one of those major questions in America. The courts are going to be deciding how far religious freedom protections extend, especially in the wake of the 2015 Supreme Court decision legalizing so-called same-sex marriage in Obergefell versus Hodges. As you know, Jeanette, the Register recently covered an issue that is caught up in the crosshairs of the religious liberty battle, and that's foster care.
Yes, we've covered it in a couple of ways, Matthew. In a few minutes, we'll bring in Joan Frawley Desmond, who's our senior editor and a writer who's covered foster care from various perspectives, mostly from the parents' perspective. But first, I wanted to talk about a story that was written by Loretta Brown. Loretta couldn't be with us today, but she is our national correspondent based in Washington, D.C., and she recently wrote about a case that's coming out of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. Which is called Fulton versus the City of Philadelphia, a woman named Charnel Fulton is a foster mom who has fostered more than 40 children. And the agency who helped place those children with Charnel Fulton is Catholic Social Services of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. Well, in March of 2018, this Catholic Social Services came under fire for telling the Philadelphia Inquirer newspaper that they, as a matter of Catholic belief and Catholic practice, would not place a child in a same-sex household with a same-sex couple. They hadn't been asked to do so. No couple ever came to them and asked. But in a matter of an interview, they told the Philadelphia Inquirer that they would not do so because of religious conscience objections. And the next thing you know, the city of Philadelphia is revoking their license for discrimination. And so, go ahead, jump in.
Well, I was going to say, Loretta's story is the perfect title. It's Supreme Court and Religious Liberty. Catholic foster care case looms. And I think loom is sort of one of the key takeaways here, that Loretta details in great fashion. And there's a lot of legal back and forth here, but she lays it out in pretty ready and easily understood terms of what the Beckett Foundation is trying to do here. And the law group that is representing Catholic Social Services in Philadelphia, making appeals for the Third Circuit Court and other briefs that they have filed in other courts, basically making a very strong case about religious beliefs. But the big takeaway from this article, and this is why I would encourage everyone to read this, is the implications that this has. In fact, Loretta talks with Andrea Picciotti-Bear, who's a legal advisor for the Catholic Association, and I'll just leave you with this little quote that essentially, this could be a huge case for religious liberty because it's looking at, quote, any kind of partnership where faith-based agencies are being asked to certify same-sex marriage as an okay model for families as a condition for working with local or state governments. So this is going to be a potentially very broad issue, and certainly right, given the struggles that we're facing already with the so-called LGBT agenda, this could be, as the title of this article says, looming very large.
You know, Matthew, we've been putting together the August 18th edition, and in that print edition, we list the Catholic charities that have gone out of business because of cases like this. The Archdiocese of Boston, Catholic Charities of San Francisco, the Archdiocese of Washington, the Diocese of Rockford, Illinois, the Diocese of Springfield, Peoria, and Juliet in Illinois also, and the the Diocese of Providence and Buffalo, New York as well. So it's a huge impact. But, you know, I don't want to waste any more time in bringing Joan Frawley-Desmond into our conversation. Joan, you recently wrote a story about foster care from a slightly different perspective. It wasn't about cases. It wasn't about, let's say, threats to foster care because of this issue of same-sex couples wishing to adopt from Catholic agencies. Rather, it was about Catholics who have offered the gift of family to young people seeking homes. Joan, who did you speak to?
You know, it was one of the most inspiring stories I've done in a long time. I love doing this story. No cold legal analysis. Let's just get right into the home where people have to make decisions that affect, you know, every hour of the day, right? And so in one story, Mary Riley and her husband, Mary is a pro-life activist and works for the Life Legal Defense Foundation. They have 16-year, you know, teenagers, and a pro-life activist comes to them and says an African-American grandmother who's pro-life basically is hoping that they will foster and hopefully adopt her grandchild. She's not able to do it. I couldn't get into all the details, but they're kind of taken aback. Like, you know, they thought they were headed to the empty nester phase, you know, trying to save for college and in that. And all of a sudden, this is like a little preemie. They agree to do it. You know, what I thought was so striking about it is it also is sort of a lesson. It's like a simplicity of life. You know, we're not so wedded to our plans and these plans that are so terribly important and our comfort and everything that we can't be open to something like that. And it has made me really think about it. I think it's made my husband a little nervous, in fact. But let's talk about, so that was one case. They're out here in Napa, California, a great family, super active in the church and in the pro-life movement. Then there was another family in Lisa Wheeler. Some of us know Lisa because she's involved with Carmel Communications. She does a lot of work for Catholic apostolates. She and her husband couldn't have children. And so in this case, they tried all these other ways that so many couples who have these issues do struggle. They're talking to doctors. They've tried everything. And finally, they go, okay, we're going to look at something else. We're going to look at foster care to adoption. Well, since then, you know, they've adopted a child they brought into their home. The family changed their whole way of doing things. She's still working because she was more the primary breadwinner. But they really dialogued about it. He, as a former teacher, decided he would stay and care for the children. She said by the end of the year, they could have nine children, all of whom had been in adoption initially. And what's so interesting to me about this is I've heard this before. It's almost like you get exposed to this unbelievable need that so much of the country seems unaware of, including myself, really, until recently. And then once you're exposed, you're like, what more can I do? All of a sudden, you went from not even thinking about this to having, you know, multiple siblings in your home so you can keep those children together.
Yeah, you know, Joan, I was very struck by your story as well, and the stories of these, you know, three families. And but I was also struck by that dire need. How many children are out there who are in need? Tell us about this system, the numbers of children who are available for foster care.
Well, the thing, you know, that is truly astonishing, we've all, you know, heard stories recently and terrible stories about separations at the border. What we don't really grapple with is that right in this country, there's almost 500,000 foster children in the system. Mm. 500,000. I mean, think about it. It's stunning. And why are these children in the system? Lots of reasons. It may be temporary. The family just may have a temporary issue and neglect or something has been found. It could be a systemic problem of abuse or addiction-related issues. There are women who give birth to children. The women are drug addicted. And the child has to be weaned off of the impact of the drugs on their own system. one of the most touching stories was a foster care woman, a foster mom I got to speak with for some time, who's Catholic in Southern California. She's had many children, and she loves specializing in caring for these little, often premature children born to drug-addicted mothers. Obviously, you know, she doesn't love that part, but what she feels specially called for is to take these little infants, you know, and really care for them. She's learned to really figure out what it is they need. They start off very uncomfortable. They have to be held a special way. They have to be almost swaddled, you know, very tightly at times. So that's an issue. But we also have older children. I was told, like, some of the teenage kids are just so angry by now. They've been in multiple homes. Some of them are really stuck in the system. They are neither put up for adoption, nor does it appear that their parents can really take them back. So there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of hopes and dreams that don't get fulfilled, and then they're still going from home to home. And then every now and then, really getting lucky, finding a really wonderful family that is the term they use, which is really haunting and touching, is a forever family.
Wow.
So after all this up and down, I mean, it makes you cry, really.
Right, right.
All this up and down, that they finally gel with somebody and they can stay. And Jeanette, one of the things that's really touching too is that the families that do decide to adopt, they know they're dealing with children that may really have had, you know, the impact of trauma and neglect that is going to live with them for many, many years. And they learn to deal with that. And they, and for those who don't know if that child can be adopted in the end, you know, the child may be returned to their birth mother, and that might be the right thing to do if that can happen. So you should never, you know, oppose that. But their own need to want to have that child. I mean, a woman perhaps who struggled with infertility, and she and her husband now have really committed to that child, but it's not yet clear if the child will really be available. Can they love them in the moment? Can they take
right.
care of them in the moment, and setting aside where this may go, you know, if they may be disappointed down the road? Really,
yes.
really beautiful story.
It's an amazing love, and what you've written about, Joan, is this this loving like Christ loves that these couples have learned throughout this foster care process. We've been talking to Joan Frawley Desmond, Register senior editor, about foster care and some stories that she has written here on Register Radio. I'm going to change topics, Joan, because we have a lot to talk about, the things that you've written, and I hope that our listeners will go to ncregister.com and look up these foster care stories that we've been doing. There are about three of them in online and in our upcoming print edition, which is August 18th. It's worth the read, and it really, they're touching stories. But Joan, you have also covered, and the Register has been covering in our editorials and in conjunction with CNA, Catholic News Agency stories, something that's happening in Rome. It's the John Paul II Institute, which has gone through a few names in the past few years. The Institute is facing a problem between students and the new leadership of the school. The students aren't happy with the direction. I'm leaving a lot out, Joan, but tell us why the students are unhappy with the current leadership of the John Paul II Institute.
I think what's really important for a little backstory, Jeanette, is to think about how distinctive this institute is. This institute was founded by John Paul back in 1981 to reflect his particularly distinctive lens on Catholic theology and philosophy and moral teaching, which, you know, has inspired so many people leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall. And what is this teaching? It's about the dignity of the human person. It's about Christ's redemptive love and capacity of the human person to receive that love and really overcome a life of sin, overcome the temptation to do wrong, the temptations that we all see out there every day, that, and as well as to actually advance and embrace the good in our marriage and family life, the good in the workplace, in the culture, in our, if we're single, you know, in decisions related to sexuality. And so it's a Christian anthropology. It's an integrated vision of life about how we should go about the good and our capacity to really do this, as opposed to saying, well, this is just too much. It's a nice ideal, but we can't really reach that. These students have come there to learn about this integrated vision of life and have the ability to teach it, whether as academics or as, you know, as high school teachers in some cases, in apostolates, and as pastors. So you have lots of people from all over the world that have gone to the John Paul II Institute. Don't forget, we also have additional what they call sessions, which are sort of satellite schools teaching this as well in different parts of the world, including Washington, D.C.
So, and Joan, you're an alum of that. Joan, you're an alum of that in, session in Washington, D.C., right?
Indeed, I am. And so, you know, I take this very personally, Jeanette, but, you know, I have to stand back and, of course, be the objective journalist at the same time here.
Right.
But what these students are worried about is two or three important things have happened. First, there was news of a refounding, a so-called refounding of the Institute to expand dealing with, to expand the course offerings and to appoint new faculty to reflect areas of development in the social sciences. You know, in one way, there's no reason why that should be a problem. The social sciences are already studied at the Institute. There's pastoral teaching that includes all kinds of information about evaluating families as a pastor would do to figure out, you know, what happens to this family if they have a particular problem. Then there, so that's okay. You know, there's some developments there. But people have then wondered, well, what happens with the core program, which is moral theology? There was a chair of moral theology held most recently by the former president, Monsignor Molina. He is a key figure, and what has happened is he has, his position has, both the chair and him himself have been, quote, terminated as a result of this refounding. The Institute's new leadership has said, oh, no, he wasn't fired. He was just terminated as a result of the changes in statutes. But that's not how people see it. And then there have also been changes in course offerings and new appointments of academics that some fear or some say, including George Weigel, do not actually hold with some fundamental teachings that were so close to John Paul's own legacy, Humanae Vitae, and, of course, right, his own teaching, Veritatis Splendor, which the key part of that, Jeanette, at this time of moral relativism, was that he said there are some actions which of themselves are intrinsically evil and can never be justified no matter the situation. They are now worried that these teachings are under threat.
Well, and Joan, right, what role does Amoris Laetitia play in this? Because we're hearing some discussion, some concern that Amoris Laetitia is sort of replacing Evangelium Vitae. Now, they're both papal documents, and certainly Amoris can be controversial, particularly Chapter 8. But how has it happened that we have the students who are very concerned about this, and now we're dragging in as well the whole pontificate of Pope Francis, one could argue very unfairly?
Well, it's a tricky issue, and I can't probably do justice to the full, you know, the scope of this debate. But here's a way of looking at it. Monsignor Molina has been criticized in the pages of the Italian Bishops' Conference. So let's go back for a minute and say two things. On the one hand, we have Amoris Laetitia. That was in 2016. Amoris Laetitia then marked a new era in which there would be, according to many, a new pastoral paradigm. This paradigm would not insist that people already fulfill or adhere to the moral law on marriage involving divorce and civilly remarried people, that they could previously not receive communion without an annulment. Or in other cases, even involving same-sex unions, of course, the Church has barred people involved actively in a homosexual relationship from receiving communion. There has been a discussion that there needs to be a new pastoral paradigm that allows people to receive communion, be part actively of the Church, well, in the process of resolving these issues at some point, and there's supposed to be a pastoral accompaniment that occurs. So the question Molina, Monsignor Molina, had is, he was raising questions about this and has since been attacked as, quote, correcting Pope Francis's new model of pastoral engagement. Monsignor Molina has come back in his own comments in the media saying, I am not, you know, attacking the Pope, but I do have the right to, quote, interpret any papal teaching within the lens of Catholic tradition. And that's what he said he was doing. He is not going outside the tradition, as some used to do in attacking John Paul, for example, saying that his teachings were not, you know, were wrong for one reason or another. He's saying, I am interpreting this from within the lens of Catholic tradition.
Right.
I should be allowed to do that. And he is saying, if I'm not allowed to do that, then academic freedom in the church is now at risk.
That's right, Joan. And obviously, one of the terms we often hear to describe that tradition of and the addition of teaching into that tradition is continuity. And Pope Benedict often spoke of this continuity. And so, people like Professor Molina and other professors who are no longer going to be teaching at the Institute, we're trying to interpret Pope Francis in light of this continuity, and that's where there seems to be some disconnect. Now, of course, you know, some of this is sort of the unofficial reason why these professors have not been invited back. These are some speculations. What has been on the books what has been on the books, or let's say in the press release, as the reason why the professors or the chair has been eliminated doesn't seem to hold up to water either, though. So a press release put out by the Institute actually said, okay, well, fundamental moral theology, that chair is eliminated because it's already that subject matter is already being taught at the lower level. So you need to have a bachelor's before you enter this program. So, you know, why would we need to focus on that now? In the master's, or let's say the higher ed, you know, higher degree program. I think that we've reported in our editorial, and CNA has reported this in some of their stories, of Father Jose Granados, who is the vice president of the school, has said, well, that just doesn't hold water because there are a lot of other subject matters that are now being studied in the graduate level program that were also studied in the bachelor program. So he says, you know, these reasons that are being given by the Institute just are not addressing the concerns that are being raised. Joan, I think you've looked at this website that the students have put up with their concerns. There are, I think, last I looked, there were over 1,000 people agreeing that they were concerned. What are they actually asking for?
They want more clarification. Jeanette, I mean, imagine if you're a doctoral student, you have come there perhaps from across the world to study under Monsignor Molina, to take one example. He's a really eminent theologian. He was a longtime collaborator of Pope Emeritus Benedict, who came and delivered addresses at the Institute as well, often used the Institute for things. So this student has come here to work under Monsignor Molina, choosing this program over others, perhaps already investing significant time there, is now told that this person isn't going to be there anymore. And they have to find someone else. They don't know who this person is. They have not received confirmation of new appointments. They have not received confirmation of course offerings for the fall. They have been told, reportedly, the Institute has said they have reassured students, at least some students, I'm not sure, you know, for what part of the program this involves, that they will be able to complete their course, you know, kind of flow if there's some specific things that need to be done. But whether that involves the professors that really are
matter
embracing
to them.
This, yeah, will matter to them, or professors who really even have a background in this. There seems to be questions about who, in fact, is coming. I saw One professor, Chidotti, in Italy, he's suggested that, you know, there could be, again, in this pastoral paradigm that is now being offered as a new paradigm, you know, homosexual unions could potentially be there. This is what I read recently. All of this will need more discussion.
Right.
We've tried to raise questions with the Institute about both allegations and what appears to be, in fact, happening. And they're not, you know, they're not making themselves
not
available for
right.
till the end of the month. So we really won't know more. Perhaps some of these things will be taken care of. I think what's very striking here, don't you think, Matthew and Jeanette, is they appear somewhat blindsided. I don't
right.
think this happened in the middle of the summer. It's a very strange time. I think I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but if you just stand back, a lot of things happen very quickly. They don't seem to be prepared for any of the questions. They're not prepared to answer the students.
Well,
and that's where we're at right now.
Joan, I absolutely agree. There is so much more left to be determined, and so we're going to have to leave it right there at that and expect more reporting once they do start answering. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Have you heard who's reading the Register? Why, it's Matthew Bunsen.
The National Catholic Register is that rarest of institutions in Catholic media, striving always to be faithful, orthodox, timely, and dedicated to journalistic excellence. Catholics know they can always depend on the Register for the news they need to know from an authentically Catholic perspective.
For a 3-month free subscription to the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 3 months free banner.